Track 4.
My God, I breathed. That's it? The dawn light? I remembered the scraps of conversation carried to the bridge of Wave Dancer through the ventilator from the cabin below. To get the dawn light, then we'll have to... Jimmy's voice, clear and tight with anticipation. If the dawn light is where... Again, the words repeated had puzzled me at the time. They'd stuck like burrs in my memory. I began to explain to Sherry, but I was so excited that it came tumbling out in a rush of words. She laughed, catching my excitement, but not understanding the explanations. "Hey," she protested, "you're not making sense." I began again. But halfway through I stopped and stared at her silently. "Now what is it?" She was half amused and half exasperated. "This is driving me crazy." I snatched up my fork. "The bell. You remember the bell I told you about? The one Jimmy pulled up at Gunfire Reef?" "Yes, of course. I told you it had lettering on it, half eaten away by sand." "Yes, go on." With the fork, I scratched on the butter, using it as a slate. VV, or perhaps a W, N, then a gap, and then L, and then it was worn away again. Remember? "That was it," I said. "It didn't mean anything then, but now. Look," and quickly I completed the letters. D-A-W-N, a gap, and then L-I-G-H-T, dawn light. And she stared at it, nodding slowly as it fitted together. "We have to find out about this ship, the Dawn Light." "But how?" "It should be easy. We know she was an East Indiaman. There must be records. Lloyd's, the Board of Trade." She took the letter from my hand and read it again. "The gallant colonel's luggage probably contained dirty socks and old shirts." She pulled a face and handed it back to me. "I'm short of socks," I said. Sherry packed a case, and I was relieved to see that she'd had the rare virtue of being able to travel light. She went down to speak to the tenant farmer while I packed the bags into the Chrysler. He would keep an eye on the cottage during her absence, and when she came back she merely locked the kitchen door and climbed into the Chrysler beside me. "Funny," she said. "This feels like the beginning of a long journey." "I have my plans," I warned, and leered at her. "Once I thought you looked wholesome," she said sorrowfully, "but when you do that..." "Sexy, isn't it?" I agreed, and took the Chrysler up the lane. I found a doctor in Haywards Heath. Sherry's hand had now blistered badly. Big, white, fat bags of fluid hung from her fingers like sickly grapes. He drained them and rebandaged the hand. "Feels much worse now," she murmured as we drove on northwards, and she was pale and silent with the pain of it. I respected her silence until we were into the suburbs of the city. "We'd better find some place to stay," I suggested. "Something comfortable and central." She looked across at me quizzically. "It would probably be a lot more comfortable and cheaper if we got a double room somewhere, wouldn't it?" I felt something turn over in my stomach, something warm and exciting. "Funny you should say that. I was just about to suggest the same." I know you were," she laughed for the first time in 2 hours. "I saved you the trouble." She shook her head, still laughing. "No, I'll stay with my uncle. He's got a spare room in his apartment in Pimlico. And there is a little pub round the corner. It's friendly and clean. You could do worse." "I'm crazy about your sense of humour," I muttered. She phoned the uncle from a call box while I waited in the car. "It's fixed up," she told me, as she climbed into the passenger seat. "He's at home." It was a ground floor apartment in a quiet street near the river. I carried Sherry's bag for her as she led the way and rang the doorbell. The man that opened the door was small and lightly built. He was 60-ish, and he wore a grey cardigan, darned at the elbows. His feet were thrust into carpet slippers. The homely attire was somehow incongruous, for his iron-grey hair was neatly cropped, as was the short, stiff moustache. His skin was clear and ruddy, but it was the fierce, predatory glint of the eye and the military set of the shoulders that warned me. This man was aware. "My uncle, Dan Wheeler." Sherry stood aside to introduce us. "Uncle Dan, this is Harry Fletcher." "The young man you were telling me about?" He nodded abruptly. His hand was bony and dry, and his gaze stung like nettles. "Come in, come in, both of you." "I won't bother you, sir." It was quite natural to call him that, an echo of my military training from so long ago. "I want to find Diggs myself." Uncle Dan and Sherry exchanged glances, and I thought she shook her head almost imperceptibly. But I was looking beyond them into the apartment. It was monastic, completely masculine, in the severity and economy of furniture and ornaments. Somehow that room seemed to confirm my first impressions of the man. I wanted as little to do with him as I could, while seeing as much of Sherry as I possibly could. "I'll pick you up in an hour for lunch, Sherry." And when she agreed, I left them and returned to the Chrysler. The pub that Sherry recommended was the Windsor Arms, and when I mentioned the uncle's name, as she suggested, they put me in a quiet back room with a fine view of sky and television aerials. I lay on the bed, fully clothed, and considered the North family and its relatives, while I waited for the hour to run by. Of one thing only was I certain, that Sherry North II was not going to pass me silently in the night. I was going to keep pretty close station upon her. And yet there was much about her that still puzzled me. I suspected that she was a more complicated person than her serene and lovely face suggested. It was going to be interesting finding out. I put the thought aside, sat up, and reached for the telephone. I made 3 phone calls in the next 20 minutes. One to Lloyd's Register of Shipping in Fenchurch Street, another to the National Maritime Museum at Greenwich, and the last to the India Office Library in Blackfriars Road. I left the Chrysler in the private parking lot behind the pub. A car is more trouble than it's worth in London, and I walked back to the uncle's apartment. Sherry answered the door herself, and she was ready to leave. I liked that about her. She was punctual. "You didn't like Uncle Dan, did you?" She challenged me over the lunch table, and I ducked. "I made some phone calls. The place we're looking for is in Blackfriars Road, Westminster, the India Office Library. We'll go down there after we've eaten." "He really is very sweet when you get to know him." "Look, darling, he's your uncle. You keep him." "But why, Harry? It interests me." "What does he do for a living? Army? Navy?" She stared at me. "How did you know that?" "Oh, I can pick him out of a crowd." "He's army, but retired. Why should that make a difference?" "What are you going to try?" And I waved the menu at her. "If you take the roast beef, I'll go for the duck." And she accepted the decoy and concentrated on the food. The India Office archives were housed in one of those square modern blocks of greenish glass and Air Force blue steel panels. Sherry and I armed ourselves with visitors' passes and signed the book. We made our way first to the catalogue room, and thence to the marine section of the archives. These were presided over by a neatly dressed but stern-faced lady with greying hair and steel-rimmed spectacles. I handed her a requisition slip for the dossier, which would include material on the Honourable Company's ship Dawn Light, and she disappeared amongst the laden ceiling-high tiers of steel shelving. It was 20 minutes before she returned and placed a bulky dossier on the countertop before me. "You have to sign here," she told me, indicating a column on the stiff cardboard folder. "Huh, funny," she remarked. "You're the second one who's asked for this file in less than a year." I stared at the signature, J.A. North, in the last space. We were following closely in Jimmy's footsteps. I signed Richard Smith, below his name. You can use one of the desks over there, dear, she pointed across the room. Please try and keep the file tidy, won't you, then? Sherry and I sat down at the desk, shoulder to shoulder, and I untied the tape that secured the file. The Dawn Light was of the type known as the Blackwall Frigate, characteristically built at the Blackwall Yards in the early 19th century. The type was very similar to the naval frigates of that period. She'd been built at Sunderland for the Honourable English East India Company, and she was of 1,330 net registered tons. At the waterline, her dimensions were 226 feet, with a beam of 26 feet. Such a narrow beam would have made her very fast, but very uncomfortable in a stiff blow. She'd been launched in 1832, just the year before the company lost its China monopoly, and this stroke of ill fortune seemed to have dogged her whole career. Also in the files were a whole series of reports of the proceedings of various courts of inquiry. Her first master gloried in the name of Hogg, and on her maiden voyage he piled the Dawn Light onto the bank at Diamond Harbour in Hooghly River. He was found by the court of inquiry to be under the influence of strong drink at the time, and stripped of his command. "Made a pig of himself," I observed to Sherry, and she groaned softly and rolled her eyes at my wit. The trail of misfortune continued. In 1840, while making passage in the South Atlantic, the elderly mate, who had the dog watch, let her come up, and away went her masts. Wallowing hapless, with her top hamper dragging alongside, she was found by a Dutchman. They cut away the wreckage, and she was dragged into Table Bay. The salvage court made an award of £12,000. In 1846, while half her crew were ashore on the wild coast of New Guinea, they were set upon by the cannibals and slaughtered to a man. 63 of her crew died. Then, on the 23rd of September 1857, she sailed from Bombay, outward bound for St. Mary's, the Cape of Good Hope, St. Helena, and the Pool of London. The date, I placed my finger on the line. This is the voyage that Goodchild talked of in his letter. Sherry nodded without reply. I had learnt in the last few minutes that she read faster than I did. I had to restrain her from turning each page when I was only three quarters finished. Now her eyes darted across each line. Her colour was up. There was a soft flush on her pale cheeks, and she was biting her underlip. "Oh, come on," she urged me. "Hurry up." And I had to hold her wrist. The Dawn Light never reached St. Mary's. She disappeared. 3 months later, she was considered lost at sea, with all hands, and the underwriters were ordered by Lloyd's to make good their assurances to the owners and shippers. The manifest of her cargo was impressive for such a small ship, for she'd loaded out of China and India a cargo that consisted of 364 chests of tea and 494 half chests of tea, 72 tons on behalf of Messrs. Dunbar and Green, 101 chests of tea and 618 half chests of tea, 65 tons on behalf of Messrs. Simpson, Willie and Livingston, 577 bales of silk, 82 tons on behalf of Messrs. Elder and Company, 5 cases goods, 4 tons on behalf of Colonel Sir Roger Goodchild, 16 cases goods, 6 tons on behalf of Major John Cotton, 10 cases goods, 2 tons on behalf of Lord Elton, 26 boxes of various spices, 2 tons on behalf of Messrs. Polson and Company. Wordlessly, I laid my finger on the fourth item of the manifest. Sherry nodded, with her eyes shining like sapphires. The claim had been settled and the matter appeared closed, until 4 months later, in April 1858, the East Indiaman Walmer Castle arrived in England, carrying aboard the survivors from the Dawn Light. There were 6 of them, the first mate, Andrew Barlow, a boatswain's mate, and 3 topmast men. There was also a young woman of 22 years, a Miss Charlotte Cotton, who had been a passenger making the homeward passage with her father, a major in the 40th Foot. The mate, Andrew Barlow, gave his evidence to the court of inquiry, and beneath the dry narrative and the ponderous questions and the guarded replies lay an exciting and romantic story of the sea, an epic of shipwreck and survival. As we read, I saw the meager scraps of knowledge I had scraped together fit neatly into the story. 14 days out from Bombay, the Dawn Light was set upon by a furious storm out of the southeast. For 7 days, the savagery of the storm raged unabated, driving the ship before her. I could imagine it clearly, one of those great cyclones that had torn the roof from my own shack at Turtle Bay. Once again, Dawn Light was dismasted. No spars were left standing except the fore lower mast, mizzen lower mast, and bowsprit. The rest had carried away on the tempest, and there was no opportunity to set up a jury mainmast or send yards aloft in the mountainous seas. Thus, when land was sighted to leeward, there was no chance that the ship might avoid her fate. A conspiracy of wind and current hurled her down into the throat of a funnel-shaped reef upon which the storm surf burst like the thunder of the heavens. The ship struck and held, and Andrew Barlow was able, with the help of 12 members of his crew, to launch one of the boats. 4 passengers, including Miss Charlotte Cotton, left the stricken ship with them, and Barlow, with an unlikely combination of good fortune and seamanship, was able to find a passage through the wild sea and murderous reefs into the quieter waters of the inshore channel. Finally, they ran the boat ashore on the spindrift-smothered beach of an island. Here the survivors huddled for 4 days while the cyclone blew itself out. Barlow alone climbed to the summit of the southernmost of the treble peaks of the island. The description was completely clear. It was the Old Man and Gunfire Reef. There was no doubt of it. This, then, was how Jimmy North had known what he was looking for. The island with 3 peaks and a barrier of coral reef. Barlow took bearings off the sea-battered hull of the Dawn Light as she lay in the jaws of the reef, swept by each successive wave. On the second day, the ship's hull began to break up, and while Barlow watched from the peak, the front half of her was carried up over the reef to disappear into a dark, gaping hole in the coral. The stern fell back into the sea and was smashed to matchwood. When at last the skies cleared and the wind dropped, Andrew Barlow discovered that his small party were all that survived from a ship's company of 149 souls. The others had perished in the wild sea. To the west, low against the horizon, he descried a low landmass which he hoped was the South African mainland. He embarked his party in the ship's boat once more, and they made the crossing of the inshore channel. His hopes were fulfilled. It was Africa. But, as always, she was hostile and cruel. The 17 lost beings began a long and dangerous journey southwards, and 3 months later only Barlow, 4 seamen, and Miss Charlotte Cotton reached the island port of Zanzibar. Fever, wild animals, wild men, and sheer misfortune had whittled away their numbers, and even those who survived were starved to gaunt living skeletons, yellowed with fever and riddled with dysentery from foul water. The court of inquiry had highly commended Andrew Barlow, and the Honourable Company had made him an award of £500 for meritorious service. When I finished reading, I looked up at Sherry. She was watching me. "Wow," she said, and I also felt drained by the magnitude of the old drama. "It all fits, Sherry," I said. "It's all there." "Yes. We must see if they have the drawings here." The prints and drawings room was on the 3rd floor, and a quick search by an assistant soon revealed the Dawn Light in all her splendour. She was a graceful 3-masted ship with a long, low profile. She had no crossjack or mizzen course. Instead, she carried a large spanker and a full set of studding sails. The long poop gave space for several passenger cabins, and she carried her boats on top of her deckhouse aft. She was heavily armed with 13 black-painted gunboats, aside from which she could run out her long 18-pounder cannon to defend herself in those hostile seas east of the Cape of Good Hope, across which she plied to China and India. "I need a drink," I said, and picked up the drawings of the Dawn Light. "I'll get them to make copies of these for us."
"What for?" Sherry wanted to know.
The assistant emerged from her lair among the pile trays of old prints and sucked in her cheeks at my request for copies. "I shall have to charge you 75 pence. She tried to discourage me.
"Well, that's reasonable," I said.
"And we won't have them ready until next week," she added inexorably.
"Oh, dear,"
said I, and gave her the smile. "I did need them tomorrow afternoon." The smile crushed her. She lost the air of purpose and tried to tuck her straying wisps of hair into the side frames of her glasses.
"Well, I'll see what I can do then," she relented.
"That's very sweet of you, really it is." And we left her looking confused but pleased. My sense of direction was returning, and I found my way to Elvino's without trouble. The evening flood of journalists from Fleet Street had not yet swamped it, and we found a table at the back. I ordered 2 vermouths, and we saluted each other over the glasses.
"You know, Harry, Jimmy had 100 schemes. His whole life was one great treasure hunt. Every week he had found, almost found, the location of a treasure ship from the Armada, or a sunken Aztec city, a buccaneer wreck." She shrugged. "I have a built-in resistance to believing any of it. But this one..." And she sipped the wine.
"Well, let's go over what we have," I suggested. "We know that Goodchild was very concerned that his agent receive 5 cases of luggage and put it into safekeeping. We know that he was going to board it Dawn Light, and he sent advance notice, probably through a personal friend, the captain of the naval frigate Panther."
"Yes, good," she agreed.
"We know that those cases were listed on the ship's manifest, that the ship was lost, presumably with them still on board. We know the exact location of the wreck. We've had it confirmed by the ship's bell."
"Still good."
"We only don't know what those cases contained."
"Dirty socks," she said.
4 tons of dirty socks?" I asked, and her expression changed. The weight of the cargo had not meant anything to her.
"Ah,"
and I grinned at her. "Went over your head. I thought so. You read so fast you only take in half of it." She pulled a face at me.
4 tons, my darling girl, is a great deal of something, whatever it is."
"All right," she agreed. "Figures don't mean much to me, I admit. But it sounds a lot."
"Well, roughly the same weight as a new Rolls-Royce, to put it in terms you might understand."
And her eyes widened and turned a darker blue.
"That is a lot."
"Jimmy obviously knew what it was, and had proof sufficient to convince some very hard-headed backers. And they took it seriously.
Seriously enough to..."
And she stopped herself. For an instant, I saw the old grief for Jimmy's death in her eyes. I was embarrassed by it, and I looked away, making a show of taking a letter out of my inner pocket. Carefully, I spread it on the tabletop between us. When I looked at her again, she'd recovered her composure once more. The penciled note in the margin engaged my attention again. B. Muss, E6914(8). I read it aloud. "Any ideas?"
"Bachelor of Music."
"Oh, that's great," I applauded.
"All right, you do better," she challenged.
I folded the letter away with dignity and ordered 2 more drinks. "Well, that was a good run on that scent," I said when I'd paid the waiter. "We have an idea what it was all about. Now we can go on my other lead." She sat forward and encouraged me silently. "I told you about your impostor, the blonde Sherry North," and she nodded. "On the night before she left the island, she sent a cable to London." I produced the flimsy from my wallet and handed it to Sherry. While she read it, I went on. "This was clearly an okay to her principal, Manson. He must be the big man behind this. I'm going to start moving in on him now." I finished my vermouth.
I'll drop you back with your martial uncle and contact you again tomorrow. Her lips set in a line of stubbornness, which I'd not seen before, and there was a glint in her eyes like the blue of gunmetal. Harry Fletcher, if you think you're going to ditch me just when things are livening up, you must be off your tiny head. The cab dropped us in Berkeley Square, and I led her into Curzon Street. Take my arm, quickly, I muttered, glancing over my shoulder in a secretive manner. Instantly she obeyed. Then we'd gone 50 yards before she whispered, Why? Because I like the feel of it. I grinned at her and spoke in a natural voice. Oh, you! She made as if to pull away, but I held her and she capitulated. We sauntered up the street towards Shepherd Market, stopping now and then to window shop like a pair of tourists. Number 97 Curzon Street was one of those astronomically expensive apartment blocks, 6 stories of brick facing, and an ornate street door of bronze and glass beyond, which was a marbled foyer guarded by a uniformed doorman. We went on past it, up as far as the White Elephant Club, and there we crossed the street and wandered back on the opposite pavement. I could go and ask the doorman if Mr. Manson occupied flat number 5, Sherry volunteered. Great, I said. And then he says yes. What do you do then? Tell him Harry Fletcher says hello. You really are very droll, she said, and once more she tried to take her hand away. There's a restaurant diagonally opposite number 97. I prevented her withdrawal. Let's get a table in the front window, drink some coffee, and watch for a while. It was a little past 3 o'clock when we settled at the window seat with a good view across the street, and the next hour passed pleasantly. I found it not a difficult task to keep Sherry amused. We shared a similar sense of humour, and I liked to hear her laugh. I was in the middle of a long, complicated story when I was interrupted by the arrival outside number 97 of a silver Wraith Rolls-Royce. It pulled to the curb, and a chauffeur in a smart dove-grey uniform left the car and entered the foyer. He and the doorman fell into conversation, and I resumed my story. 10 minutes later, there was sudden activity opposite. The elevator began a series of rapid ascents and descents, each time discharging a load of matching crocodile skin luggage. This was carried out by the doorman and chauffeur and packed into the rolls. It seemed endless. And Sherry remarked, Somebody's off on a long holiday, and she sighed wistfully. How do you fancy a tropical island with blue water and white sands and a thatched shack amongst the palms? Oh, stop it, she said. On an autumn day in old London, I just can't bear the thought. I was about to move into a stronger position when the footman and the chauffeur stood to attention and once more the glass doors of the lift opened and a man and a woman stepped out of it. The woman wore a full-length honey mink and her blonde hair was piled high on her head in an elaborate lacquered Grecian style. Anger struck me like a fist in the guts as I recognized her. It was Sherry North, the first. The nice lady who had blown Judith and Wave Dancer to the bottom of Grand Harbour. With her was a man of medium height with soft brown hair, fashionably long and curly over his ears. He had a light tan, probably from a sun lamp, and he was dressed too well. Very expensively, but as flamboyantly as an entertainment personality. He had a heavy jaw and a long, fleshy nose with soft gazelle eyes, but his mouth was pinched and hungry. A greedy mouth that I remembered so well. Manson, I said. Jesus! Manson Resnick. Manny Resnick. He would be just the one Jimmy North would find his way to with his outrageous proposition. In exactly the same way that so long ago I had gone with him with my plans for the gold heist at Rome Airport. Manny was an underworld entrepreneur, and he had clearly climbed a long way up the ladder since our last meeting. He was keeping great style now, I thought, as he crossed the pavement and entered the back seat of the Rolls, settling down next to the mink-clad blonde. Wait here, I told Sherry urgently, as the Rolls pulled away towards Park Lane. I ran out onto the pavement and searched wildly for a cab to follow them. There was none, and I ran after the rolls, praying desperately for the sight of a big black cab with its top light burning. But ahead of me, the rolls swung right into South Audley Street and accelerated smoothly away. I stopped at the corner, and it was already far ahead, infiltrating the traffic towards Grosvenor Square. I turned and ambled disappointedly back to where Sherry waited. I knew that Sherry had been correct. Manny and the blonde were off on a long journey. There was no point in hanging around number 97 Curzon Street any longer. Sherry was waiting for me outside the restaurant. "Well, what was that all about?" she demanded, and I took her arm. As we walked back towards Berkeley Square, I told her. "That man is probably the one who ordered Jimmy murdered, who was responsible for having half my chest shot away, who had them to roast your lovely pinkies. In short, the big man."
"You know him?"
"I did business with him a long time ago."
"Nice friends you have."
"Well, I'm trying for a better class lately," I said, and squeezed her arm. But she ignored my gallantry.
"And the woman? Is she the one from St. Mary's? The one who blew up your boat and the young girl?"
I experienced a violent return of the anger which had gripped me a few minutes earlier when I'd seen that sleek, meticulously polished predator dressed in mink. Beside me, Sherry gasped.
"Harry, Harry, you're hurting me."
"Oh, I'm sorry." And I relaxed my grip on her arm. "Well, I guess that answers my question," she muttered ruefully, and massaged her upper arm. The private bar of the Windsor Arms was all dark oak panels and antique mirrors. It was crowded by the time Sherry and I returned. Outside, darkness had fallen, and there was an icy wind stirring the fallen leaves in the gutters. The warmth of the pub was welcome. We found seats in a corner, but the crowd pushed us together, forcing me to place an arm round Sherry's shoulders, and our heads were so close we could hold a very private conversation in this public place. "I can guess where Manny Resnick and his friend are headed," I said. "Big Gull Island?" Sherry asked. And when I nodded, she went on, "He'll need a boat and divers." "Oh, don't worry. Manny'll get them."
"And what will we do?"
"We?" I asked.
"A form of speech."
She corrected herself primly.
"What will you do?"
"I have a choice. I can forget about it all. Or I can go back to Gunfire Reef and try to find out what the hell was in Colonel Goodchild's five cases."
"You'll need equipment."
"It might not be as elaborate as Manny Resnick's will be, but I could get enough together."
"How are you for money?
Or is that a rude question?" "The answer's the same. I could get enough together."
"Blue water and white sand," she murmured dreamily.
"And the palm fronds chattering in the trade winds?"
"Oh, stop it, Harry.
Fat crayfish grilling on the coals, and me beside you singing in the wilderness," I went on remorselessly.
"You are a pig," she said.
"If you stay here, you'll never know if it was dirty socks," I pressed her.
"But you write and tell me," she pleaded.
"I wouldn't."
"I'll have to come with you," she said at last.
"Good girl," I squeezed her shoulder.
"But I insist on paying my own way. I refuse to become a kept woman."
She had guessed how hard-pressed I was financially. "And I should hate to erode your principles," I told her happily, and my wallet sighed with relief. It was going to be a near-run thing to mount an expedition to Gunfire Reef on what I had left. There was much we had to discuss now that the decision had been made. It seemed only minutes later that the landlord was calling, "Time, gentlemen."
"The streets are dangerous at night," I warned Sherry. "I don't think we should chance it. Upstairs I have a very comfortable room with a fine view."
"Come on, Fletcher," Sherry stood up. "You'd better walk me home, or I shall set my uncle on to you." As we walked the half block to her uncle's apartment, we agreed to meet for lunch next day. I had a list of errands to perform in the morning, including making the airline reservations,
while Sherry had to have her passport renewed and pick up the photostat drawings of the dawn light. At the door of the apartment, we faced each other, suddenly both of us, very shy. It was so terribly corny that I almost laughed. We were like a pair of old-fashioned teenagers at the end of our first date. But sometimes corny feels good. "Good night, Harry," she said. And with the age-old artistry of womankind, she showed me in some indefinable manner that she was ready for kissing. Her lips were soft and warm, and the kiss went on for a long time. "My goodness," she whispered throatily, and drew away at last. "Are you sure you won't change your mind? It is a beautiful room, hot and cold water, carpets on the floor, television." She laughed shakily and pushed me gently backwards. "Good night, dear Harry," she repeated, and left me. I went out into the street and strolled back towards my pub. The wind had dropped, but I could smell the damp emanating from the river close by. The street was deserted, but the curb was lined with parked vehicles, bumper to bumper. They reached to the corner. I sauntered along the pavement in no hurry for bed, even toying with the idea of a stroll down the embankment first. My hands were thrust deep into the pockets of my car coat, and I was feeling relaxed and happy as I thought about this woman. There was a lot to think about Sherry North, much that was clear or not yet explained, but mainly I cherished the thought that perhaps here at last was something that might last longer than a night or a week or a month, something that was already strong and that would not be like the others, diminishing with the passage of time, but instead would grow even stronger. Suddenly, a voice beside me said, "Harry." It was a man's voice, a strange voice, and I turned instinctively towards it. As I did so, I knew that it was a mistake. The speaker was sitting in the back seat of one of the parked cars. It was a black Rover. The window was open, and his face was merely a pale blob in the darkness of the interior. Desperately, I tried to pull my hands out of my pockets and turned to face the direction from which I knew the attack would come. As I turned, I ducked and twisted, and something whirred past my ear and struck my shoulder a numbing blow. I struck backwards with both elbows, connecting solidly and hearing the gasp of pain. Then my hands were clear, and I was around, moving fast and weaving, for I knew they'd use the cosh again. They were just midnight shapes, menacing and huge, dressed in dark clothing. It seemed there were a legion of them, but there were only four, and one in the car. They were all big men, and one had the cosh up to strike again. I hit him under the chin with the palm of my hand, snapping his head backwards, and I thought it might have broken his neck, but he went down hard on the pavement. A knee drove for my groin, but I turned and caught it on the thigh, using the impetus of the turn to counterpunch. It was a good one, jolting me to the shoulder, and the man took it in the chest and was thrown backwards, but immediately one of them was hugging the arm, smothering it, and a fist caught me in the cheek under the eye. I felt the skin tear open. Another one was on my back, an arm around my throat throttling me, but I heaved and pushed. In a tight knot, locked together, we surged around the pavement. "Hold him still," another voice called, low and urgent. "Let me get a shot at him." "What the bloody hell do you think we're trying to do?" panted another, and we fell against the side of the Rover. I was pinned there, and I saw the one with the cosh was on his feet. He swung again, and I tried to roll my head, but it caught me in the temple. It didn't put me out completely, but it knocked all the fight out of me. I was instantly weak as a child and hardly able to support my own weight. "That's it. Get him into the back." They hustled me into the center seat in the back of the Rover, and one of them crowded in on each side of me. The doors slammed, the engine whirred, and we pulled away swiftly. My brain cleared, but the side of my head was numb and felt like a balloon. There were three of them in the front seat, one on each side of me in the back. All of them were breathing heavily, and the one next to the driver was massaging his neck and jaw tenderly. The one on my right had been eating garlic, and he panted heavily as he searched me for weapons.
I think you should know that something died in your mouth a long time ago, and it's still there, I told him, with a thickened tongue and an ache in the back of my head. But the effort wasn't worth it. He showed no sign of having heard, but continued doggedly with this task. At last he was satisfied, and I readjusted my clothing. We drove in silence for 5 minutes, following the river towards Hammersmith, before they'd all recovered their breath and tended their wounds. And then the driver spoke. "Listen, Manny wants to talk to you. But he said it's no big thing. He was merely curious. He said also that if you give us a hard time, not to go to no trouble, just to sign you off and toss you in the river."
Charming chap, Manny, I said.
"Shut up," said the driver.
"But you see, it's up to you. Behave yourself, and you get to live a little longer. I heard you used to be a sharp operator, Harry. We've been expecting you to show up, ever since Lorna missed you on the island. But sure as hell we didn't expect you to parade up and down Curzon Street like a brass band." Manny couldn't hardly believe it. He said, "That can't be Harry, he must have gone soft."
Made him sad.
"How are the mighty fallen? Tell it not in the streets of Ashkelon," he said.
"Ah, that's Shakespeare," said the one with the garlic breath.
"Shut up," said the driver, and then went on.
Manny was sad, but not that sad that he cried or anything, you understand?
"Yes, I understand," I mumbled.
"Shut up," said the driver.
"Manny said, don't do it here. Just follow him to a nice quiet place and pick him up. If he comes quietly, you bring him to talk to me. If he cuts up rough, then toss him in the river."
"Ah, that sounds like my boy Manny. He always was a soft-hearted little devil."
"Shut up," said the driver.
"I look forward to seeing him again. You just stay good and quiet and you might get lucky." I stayed that way through the night as we picked up the M4 and rushed westwards. It was 2 in the morning when we entered Bristol, skirting the city centre as we followed the A4 down to Avonmouth. Among the other craft in the yacht basin was a big motor yacht. She was moored to the wharf and she had a gangplank down. Her name, painted on the stern and bows, was Mandrake. She was an ocean-goer, steel-hulled, painted blue and white, with pleasing lines. I judged her fast and sea-kindly, probably with sufficient range to take her anywhere in the world. A rich man's toy. There were figures on her bridge, lights burning in most of her portholes, and she seemed ready for sea. They crowded me as we crossed the narrow space to the gangplank. The rover backed and turned and drove away as we climbed to the Mandrake's deck. The saloon was too tastefully fitted out for Manny Resnick style. It had been either done by the previous owners or a professional decorator. There were forest green wall-to-wall carpets and matching velvet curtains. The furniture was dark teak and polished leather, and the pictures were choice oils toned to the general decor. This was £500,000 worth of vessel, and I guessed it was a charter. Manny had probably taken her for 6 months and put in his own crew, for Manny Resnick had never struck me as a blue water man. As we waited in the centre of the wall-to-wall carpeting, a grimly silent group, I heard the unmistakable sounds of the gangplank being taken in and the moorings cast off. The tremble of her engines became a steady beat, and the harbour lights slid past the saloon portholes as we left the entrance and thrust out into the tidal waters of the River Severn. I recognised the lighthouses at Portishead Point and Redcliffe Bay as Mandrake came around for the run downriver past Weston-super-Mare and Bury for the open sea. Manny came at last. He wore his blue silk gown, and his face was still crumpled from sleep, but his curls were neatly combed, and his smile was white and hungry.
"Harry," he said, "I told you you'd be back."
"Hello, Manny. I can't say it's any great pleasure." He laughed lightly and turned to the woman as she followed him into the saloon. She was carefully made up, and every hair of the elaborate hairstyle was in place. She wore a long white house gown with lace at throat and cuffs.
You've met Lorna, I believe. Lorna Page. Next time you send somebody to hustle me, Manny, try for a little better class. I'm getting fussy in my old age. Her eyes slanted wickedly, but she smiled. How's your boat, Harry? Your lovely boat? It makes a lousy coffin. I turned back to Manny. What's it going to be, Manny? Can we work out a deal? He shook his head sorrowfully. I don't think so, Harry. I would like to. Truly, I would. If just for old time's sake. But I can't see it. Firstly, you haven't anything to trade, and that makes for a lousy deal. Secondly, I know you are too sentimental. You'd louse up any deal we did make for purely emotional reasons. I couldn't trust you, Harry. All the time you'd be thinking about Jimmy North and your boat. You'd be thinking about the little island girl that got in the way and about Jimmy North's sister whom we had to get rid of. I took a mild pleasure in the fact that Manny had obviously not heard what had happened to the goon squad he had sent to take care of Sherry North, and that she was still very much alive. I tried to make my voice sincere and my manner convincing. Listen, Manny, I'm a survivor. I can forget anything, if I have to. He laughed again. If I didn't know you better, I'd believe you, Harry. He shook his head again. Sorry, Harry. No deal. Why did you go to all the trouble, then, to bring me down here? I sent others to do the job twice before, Harry. Both times they missed you. This time I want to make sure. We will be cruising over some deep water on the way to Cape Town, and I'm going to hang some really heavy weights onto you. Cape Town? I asked. So you're going after the Dawn Light in person? What is so fascinating about that old wreck? Come on, Harry. If you didn't know, we wouldn't be giving me such a hard time. He laughed, and I thought it best not to let them know my ignorance. You think you can find your way back? I asked the blonde. It's a big sea, and a lot of islands look the same. I think you should keep me as insurance, I insisted. Sorry, Harry. Manny crossed to the teak and brass bar. Drink? He asked. Scotch, I said. And he half filled a glass with the liquor and brought it to me. To be entirely truthful with you, part of this is for Lorna's benefit. You made the girl bitter, Harry. I don't know why. But you wanted especially to be there when we say goodbye. She enjoys the sort of thing, don't you, darling? It turns her on. I drained the glass. She needs turning on, as you and I both know. She's a lousy lay without it, I observed. And Manny hit me in the mouth, crushing my lips, and the whiskey stung the raw flesh. Lock him up, he said softly. As they hustled me out of the saloon and along the deck toward the bows, I took pleasure in knowing that Lorna would have some painful questions to answer. On the other hand, the shore lights moved steadily past us in the night, and the river was black and wide. Forward of the bridge, there was a low deckhouse above the forecastle, and a louvered companionway opened on to a deck ladder that descended to a small lobby. This was obviously the crew's quarters. Doors opened off the lobby into cabins and a communal mess. In the bows was a steel door, and a stencil sign upon it read, Forecastle Store. They shoved me through the doorway and slammed the heavy door. The lock turned, and I was alone in a steel cubicle, probably 6x4. Both bulkheads were lined with storage lockers, and the air was damp and musty. My first concern was to find some sort of weapon. The cupboards were all of them locked, and I saw that the planking was inch-thick oak. I would need an axe to hack them open. Nevertheless, I tried. I attempted to break in the doors using my shoulder as a ram, but the space was too confined, and I couldn't work up sufficient momentum. However, the noise attracted attention. The door swung open, and one of the crew stood well back with a big ugly .41 Ruger Magnum in his hand.
"Cut it out," he said. "There ain't nothing in there."
And then he gestured toward the pile of old life jackets against the far wall.
"You just sit there nice and quiet, or I'll call some of the boys to help me wake you over."
He slammed the door, and I sank down onto the life jackets. There was clearly a guard posted at the door full time. The others would be within easy call. I hadn't expected him to open the door, and I'd been off balance. I had to get him to do it again, but this time I would have a go. It was a poor chance, I realized. All he had to do was to point that cannon into the storeroom and pull the trigger. He could hardly miss. I needed some sort of distraction, some sort of cover to get close enough. I looked longingly at the lockers again, and then turned my attention to my own pockets. They'd cleaned me out. My lighter and cheroots, car keys, penknife, all were gone. But they had left my handkerchief, 3 5-pound notes folded into my hip pocket they'd overlooked, and I had my wristwatch. I looked down at the pile of life jackets, and stood again to pull them aside. Beneath them was a small wooden fruit box. It contained discarded cleaning materials, a nylon floor brush, cleaning rags, a tin of Brasso, half a cake of yellow soap, and a brandy bottle half filled with clear fluid. I unscrewed the cap and sniffed. It was benzene. I sat down again and reassessed my position, trying to find a percentage in it, without much success. The light switch was outside the doorway, and the light overhead was a thick glass cover. I stood up and climbed halfway up the lockers, wedging myself there while I unscrewed the light cover and examined the bulb. It gave me a little hope. I climbed down again and selected one of the heavy canvas life jackets. The clasp of the steel strap on my wristwatch made a blunt blade, and I sawed and hacked at the canvas, tearing a hole large enough to get my finger in. I ripped the canvas open and pulled out handfuls of the white kapok stuffing. I piled it on the floor, tearing open more life jackets until I had a considerable heap. I soaked the cotton waste with benzene from the bottle, and took a handful of it with me when I climbed again to the light fitting. I removed the bulb and was plunged instantly into darkness. Working by sense of touch alone, I pressed the benzene-soaked stuffing close to the electricity terminals. I had nothing to use as insulation, so I held the steel strap of my wristwatch in my bare hands and used it to dead-short the terminals. There was a sizzling blue flash. The benzene ignited instantly, and 180 volts hit me like a charge of buckshot, knocking me off my perch. I fell in a heap onto the deck, with a ball of flaming kapok in my hands. Outside I heard faint shouts of annoyance and anger. I had succeeded in shorting the entire lighting system of the forecastle. Quickly I tossed the burning kapok onto the prepared pile, and it burnt up finely. I brushed the sparks from my hands, wrapped the handkerchief around my mouth and nose, snatched up one of the undamaged life belts, and went to stand against the steel door. In seconds the benzene burnt away, and the cotton began to smoulder, fiercely pouring out thick black smoke that smelt vile. It filled the store, and my eyes began to stream with tears. I tried to breathe shallowly, but the smoke tore my lungs and I coughed violently. There was another shout beyond the door. "Something's burning," and it was answered, "Well, for Christ's sake, get those lights on." It was my cue. I began beating on the steel door and screaming at the top of my voice, "Fire! The ship's on fire!" And it wasn't all acting. The smoke in my prison was thick and solid, and more boiled off the burning cotton kapok. I realized that if nobody opened that door within the next 60 seconds, I would suffocate and maybe my screams must have carried conviction. The guard swung the door open. He still carried the big Ruger revolver, and shone a flashlight into the storeroom. I had time only to notice those details, and to see that the ship's lights were still dead. Shadowy figures milled about in the gloom, some with flashlights, and then a solid black cloud of smoke boiled out of the storeroom. I came out with the smoke, like a fighting bull from its pen, desperate for clean air, and terrified at how close I'd come to suffocating. It gave strength to my efforts. The guard went sprawling under my rush, and Ruger fired as he went down. The muzzle flame was bright as a flash bulb, lighting the whole area and allowing me to get my bearings on the companion ladder to the deck. The blast of the shot was so deafening in the confined space that it seemed to paralyze the other shadowy figures. I was halfway to the ladder before one of them leapt to intercept me. I drove my shoulder into his chest and heard the wind go out of him like a punctured football. There were shouts of concern now, and another big dark figure blocked the foot of the ladder. I had gathered speed across the lobby, and I put that and all my weight into a kick that slogged into his belly, doubling him over and dropping him to his knees. As he went over, a flashlight lit his face, and I saw it was my friend with the garlicky breath. It gave me a lift of pleasure to light me on my way, and I put one foot on his shoulder and used it as a springboard to leap halfway up the ladder. Hands clutched at my ankle, but I kicked them away and dragged myself to the deck level. I had only one foot on the rungs, and I was clinging with one hand to the life jacket and with the other to the brass handrail. In that helpless moment, the doorway to the deck was blocked by yet another dark figure, and the lights went on, a sudden blinding blaze of light. The man above me was the lad with the cosh, and I saw his savage delight as he raised it over my helpless head. The only way to avoid it was to let go the handrail and drop back into the forecastle, which was filled with surging, angry goons. I looked back and was actually opening my grip, when behind me the gunman with the Ruger Magnum sat up groggily, lifted the weapon, tried to brace himself against the ship's movement, and fired at me. The heavy bullet cracked past my ear, almost splitting my eardrum, and it hit the coshman in the center of his chest. It picked him up and hurled him backwards across the deck. He hung in the rigging of the foremast with his arms spread like those of a derelict scarecrow, and with a desperate lunge I followed him out onto the deck and rolled to my feet, still clutching the life jacket. Behind me the Ruger roared again, and I heard the bullet splinter the coping of the hatch. Three running strides carried me to the rail, and I dived over the side in a gut-swooping drop until I hit the black water flat. But I was dragged deep as the boil of the propellers caught me and swirled me under. The water was shockingly cold. It seemed to drive in the walls of my lungs and probe with icy lances into the marrow of my bones. The life jacket helped pull me to the surface at last, and I looked wildly about me. The lights of the coast seemed clear and very bright, twinkling whitely across the black water. Out here in the seaway there was a chop and swell to the surface, alternately lifting and dropping me. Mandrake slid steadily onwards towards the black void of the open sea. With all her lights blazing, she looked as festive as a cruise ship as she sailed away from me. Awkwardly, I rid myself of my shoes and jacket. Then I managed to get my arms into the sleeves of the life jacket. When I looked again, Mandrake was a mile away. But suddenly, she began to turn, and from her bridge, the long, white beam of a spotlight leapt out and began to probe lightly and dance across the surface of the dark sea. Quickly I looked again towards the land, seeking and finding the riding lights of the buoy at English ground, and relating it to the lighthouse on Flatholm. Within seconds the relative bearing of the two lights had altered slightly. The tide was ebbing, and the current was setting westerly. I turned with it and began to swim. The mandrake had slowed and was creeping back towards me. The spotlight turned and flared, swept and searched, and steadily it came down towards me. I pushed with the current, using a long side stroke so as not to break the surface and show white water, restraining myself from going into an overarm stroke as the brightly lit ship crept closer. The beam of the spotlight was searching the open water on the far side of Mandrake as she drew double with me. The current had pushed me out of her track, and the Mandrake was as close as she could come on this leg, about 150 yards off. But I could see the men on our bridge. Manny Resnick's blue silk gown glowed like a butterfly's wing in the bridge lights, and I could hear his voice raised angrily, but couldn't make out the words. The beam reached towards me like the long, cold, white finger of an accuser. It quartered the sea in a tight search pattern, back and across, back and across. The next pass must catch me. It reached the end of its traverse, swung out and came back. I lay full in the path of the swinging beam, but at the instant it swept over me, a charged push of the sea lifted a swell of dark water, and I dropped into the trough. The light washed over me, diffused by the crest of the swell, and it didn't check. It swept onwards in the relentless search pattern. They'd missed me. They were going on, back towards the mouth of the Severn. I lay in the harsh embrace of the canvas life jacket and watched them bear away, and I felt sick and nauseated with relief and the reaction from violence. But I was free. All I had to worry about now was how long it would take to freeze to death. I began swimming again, watching Mandrake's lights dwindle and lose themselves against the spangled backdrop of the shore. I'd left my wristwatch in the forecastle, so I didn't know how long it was before I lost all sense of feeling in my arms and legs. I tried to keep swimming, but I wasn't sure if my limbs were responding. I began to feel a wonderful, floating sense of release. The lights of the land faded out, and I seemed to be wrapped in warmth and soft white clouds. I thought that if this was dying, it wasn't as bad as its propaganda, and I giggled, lying sodden and helpless in the life jacket. I wondered with interest why my vision had gone. It wasn't the way I had heard it told. And then suddenly I realized that the sea fog had come down in the dawn, and it was this that had blinded me. However, the morning light was growing in strength. I could see clearly 20 feet into the eddying fog banks. I closed my eyes and fell asleep. My last thought was that this was probably my last thought. It made me giggle again as darkness swept over me. Voices woke me, voices very clear and close in the fog. The rich and lovely Welsh accents roused me. I tried to shout, and with a sense of great achievement, it came out like the squawk of a gull. Out of the fog loomed the dark, ungainly shape of an ancient lobster boat. It was on the drift, setting pots, and two men hung over the side, intent on their labours. I squawked again, and one of the men looked up. I had an impression of pale blue eyes in a weathered and heavily lined ruddy face, cloth cap and an old briar pipe gripped in broken yellow teeth. "Good morning," I croaked. "Jesus," said the lobster man around the stem of his pipe. I sat in the tiny wheelhouse, wrapped in a filthy old blanket, and drank steaming, unsweetened tea from a chipped enamel mug, shivering so violently that the mug leapt and twitched in my cupped hands. My whole body was a lovely shade of blue, and returning circulation was excruciating agony in my joints. My two rescuers were taciturn men, with a marvellous sense of other people's privacy, probably bred into them by a long line of buccaneers and smugglers. By the time they'd set their pots and cleared for the homeward run, it was afternoon, and I'd thawed out. My clothes had dried over the stove in the miniature galley, and I had a bellyful of brown bread and smoked mackerel sandwiches. We went into Port Talbot, and when I tried to pay them with my rumpled fivers for their help,
The older of the two lobstermen turned a blue and frosty eye upon me.
"Any time I win a man back from the sea, I am paid in full, mister. Keep your money."
The journey back to London was a nightmare of country buses and night trains. When I stumbled out of Paddington Station at 10 o'clock the next morning, I understood why a pair of bobbies paused in their majestic pacing to study my face. I must have looked like an escaped convict. The cabby ran a world-weary eye over my 2 days' growth of dark, stiff beard, the swollen lip, and the bruised eye.
"Did your husband come home early, mate?"
he asked,
and I groaned weakly.
Sherry North opened the door to her uncle's apartment and stared at me with huge, startled eyes.
"Oh, God, Harry, what on earth has happened to you? You look terrible."
"Thanks," I said. "That really cheers me up."
She caught my arm and drew me into the apartment.
"I've been going out of my mind. 2 days. I've even called the police, the hospitals, everywhere I could think of."
The uncle was hovering in the background, and his presence set my nerves on edge. I refused the offer of a bath and clean clothes, and instead I took Sherry back with me to the Windsor Arms. I left the door to the bathroom open while I shaved and bathed so that we could talk, and although she kept out of direct line of sight while I was in the tub, I thought it was developing a useful sense of intimacy between us. I told her in detail of my abduction by Manny Resnick's trained guerrillas and of my escape, making no attempt to play down my own heroic role, and she listened in a silence that I could only believe was fascinated admiration. I emerged from the bath with a towel wound round my waist and sat on the bed to finish the tale, while Sherry doctored my cuts and abrasions. "You'll have to go to the police now, Harry," she said at last. "They tried to murder you."
"Sherry, my darling girl, please don't keep talking about the police. You make me nervous."
"But, Harry..."
"Forget about the police and order some food for us. I haven't eaten since I can't remember when."
The hotel kitchen sent up a fine grilling of bacon and tomatoes, fried eggs, toast and tea. While I ate, I tried to relate the recent rapid turn of events to our previous knowledge and alter our plans to fit in. "By the way, you were on the list of expendables. They didn't intend merely holding a barbecue with your fingers. Manny Resnick was convinced that his boys had killed you." And a queasy expression passed over her lovely face. "They were apparently getting rid of anyone who knew anything at all about the Dawn Light." I took another mouthful of egg and bacon and chewed in silence.
"At least we have a timetable now. Manny's charter, which is incidentally called Mandrake, looks very fast and powerful, but it's still going to take him 3 or 4 weeks to get out to the islands. It gives us time."
She poured tea for me, milk glass, the way I like it.
"Thanks, Sherry. You are an angel of mercy."
She stuck out her tongue at me, and I went on. "Whatever it is we're looking for, it just has to be something extraordinary. That motor yacht Manny's hired himself looks like the royal yacht. He must be laying out close to £100,000 on this little lark. God, I wish we knew what those 5 cases contain." I tried to sound Manny out, but he laughed at me. "Tell me I knew, or I wouldn't be taking so much trouble."
"Oh, Harry," Sherry's face lit up, "you've given us the bad news. Now stand by for the good."
"Well, I could stand a little."
"You know Jimmy's note on the letter, B. Muss?"
I nodded. "Bachelor of Music?"
"No, idiot. British Museum."
"I'm sorry, I'm afraid you just lose me."
"I was discussing it with Uncle Dan. He recognized it immediately. It's a reference to a work
in the library of the British Museum. He holds a reader's card. He's researching a book and works there often.
Could we get in there?
Well, we'll give it a college try. I waited almost 2 hours beneath the vast golden and blue dome of the reading room at the British Museum, and the craving for a cheroot was like a vice around my chest. I didn't know what to expect. I had simply filled in the withdrawals form, which, with Jimmy North's reference number, so when at last the attendant laid a thick volume before me, I seized it eagerly. It was a Secker and Warburg edition, first published in 1963. The author was a Dr. P.A. Reddy, and the title was printed in gold on the spine, Legendary and Lost Treasures of the World. I lingered over the closed book, teasing myself a little, and I wondered what chain of coincidence and luck had allowed Jimmy North to follow this paper chase of ancient clues. Had he read this book first in his burning obsession with wrecks and sea treasure, and then had he stumbled on the batch of old letters? I would never know. There were 49 chapters, each listing a separate item. I read carefully down the list. There were Aztec treasures of gold, the plate and bullion of Panama, buccaneer hoards, a lost gold mine in the Rockies of North America, a valley of diamonds in South Africa, treasure ships of the Armada, the Lutine bullion ship from which the famous Lutine Bell at Lloyd's had been recovered, Alexander the Great's chariot of gold, more treasure ships, both ancient and modern, from the Second World War to the sack of Troy, treasures of Mussolini, Prester John, Darius, Roman generals, privateers and pirates of Barbary and Coromandel. It was a vast profusion of facts and fancy, history and conjecture. The treasures of lost cities and forgotten civilizations, from Atlantis to the fabulous golden city of the Kalahari Desert. There was so much of it, and I didn't know where to look. With a sigh, I turned to the first page, ducking the introduction and preface, and began to read. By 5 o'clock, I'd skimmed through 16 chapters which could not possibly relate to the Dawn Light, and had read 5 others in depth, and by this time I understood how Jimmy North could have been bitten by the romance and excitement of the treasure hunter. It was making me itchy also. These stories of great riches, abandoned, waiting merely to be gathered up by someone with the luck and fortitude to ferret them out. I glanced at the new Japanese watch with which I'd replaced my Omega, and hurried out of the massive stone portals of the museum and crossed Great Russell Street to my rendezvous with Sherry. She was waiting in the crowded saloon bar of the Running Stag. Sorry, I said. I forgot the time. Come on. She grabbed my arm. I'm dying of thirst and curiosity. I gave her a pint of bitter for her thirst, but could only inflame her curiosity with the title of the book. She wanted to send me back to the library before I'd finished my supper of ham and turkey from the carvery behind the bar, but I held out and managed to smoke half a cheroot before she drove me out into the cold. I gave her the key to my room at the Windsor Arms, placed her in a cab and told her to wait for me there. Then I hurried back to the reading room. The next chapter of the book was entitled The Great Mogul and the Tiger Throne of India. It began with a brief historical introduction describing how Babur, descendant of Timur and Genghis Khan, the two infamous scourges of the ancient world, crossed the mountains into northern India and established the Mughal Empire. I recognized immediately that this fell within the area of my interest. The Dawn Light had been outward bound from that ancient continent. The history covered the period of Babur's illustrious successors, Muslim rulers who rose to great power and influence, who built mighty cities and left behind such monuments to man's sense of beauty as the Taj Mahal. Finally, it described the decline of the dynasty and its destruction in the first year of the Indian Mutiny, when the avenging British forces stormed and sacked the ancient citadel of fortress at Delhi, shooting the Mughal princes out of hand and throwing the old emperor, Bahadur Shah, into captivity. And then abruptly, the author switched his attention from the vast sweep of history. In 1665, Jean-Baptiste Tavernier, a French traveller and jeweller, visited the court of the Mughal emperor Aurangzeb. 5 years later, he published in Paris his celebrated Travels in the Orient. He seems to have won special favour from the Muslim emperor, for he was allowed to enter the fabled treasure chambers of the citadel and to catalogue various items of special interest. Amongst these was the diamond which he named the Great Mughal. Tavernier weighed this stone and listed its bulk as 280 carats. He described this paragon as possessing extraordinary fire and a colour as clear and white as the great north star of the heavens. Tavernier's host informed him that the stone had been recovered from the famed Golconda mines in about 1650, and that the rough stone had been a monstrous 787 carats. The cut of the stone was a distinctive rounded rose, but was not symmetrical, being proud on the one side. The stone had been unrecorded since that time, and many believe that Tavernier actually saw the Koh-i-Noor, or the Olaf. However, it is highly improbable that such a trained observer and craftsman as Tavernier could have erred so widely in his weights and descriptions. The Koh-i-Noor, before it was recut in London, weighed a mere 191 carats, and was certainly not a rose-cut. The Olaf, although rose-cut, was and is a symmetrical gemstone and weighs 199 carats. The description simply cannot be mated with that of Tavernier, and all the evidence points to the existence of a huge white diamond that has dropped out of the known world. In 1739, when Nadir Shah of Persia entered India and captured Delhi, he made no attempt to hold his conquest, but contented himself with vast booty, which included the Koh-i-Noor diamond and the peacock throne of Shah Jahan. It seems probable that the great Mughal diamond was overlooked by the rapacious Persian, and that after his withdrawal, Muhammad Shah, the incumbent Mughal emperor, deprived of his traditional throne, ordered the construction of a substitute. However, the existence of this new treasure was veiled in secrecy, and although there are references to its existence in the native accounts, only one European reference can be cited. The journal of the English ambassador to the court of Delhi during the year of 1747, Sir Thomas Jenning, describes an audience granted by the Mughal emperor, at which he was clad in precious silks and bedecked with flowers and jewels, seated upon a great throne of gold. The shape of the throne was as of a fierce tiger, with gaping jaws and a single glittering cyclopean eye. The body of the tiger was amazingly worked with all manner of precious stones. His Majesty was gracious enough to allow me to approach the throne closely and to examine the eye of the tiger, which, he assured me, was a great diamond descended from the reign of his ancestor, Aurangzeb. Was this Tavernier's great Mughal, now incorporated into the tiger throne of India? If it was, then credence is given to a strange set of circumstances which must end our study of this lost treasure. In 1857, on the 16th of September, desperate street fighting filled the streets of Delhi with heaps of dead and wounded, and the outcome of the struggle hung in the balance as the British forces and loyal native troops fought to clear the city of the mutinous sepoys and seize the ancient fortress that dominated the city. While the fighting raged within, a force of loyal native troops from the 101st Regiment under two European officers was ordered to cross the river and encircle the walls to seize the road to the north. This was in order to prevent members of the Mughal royal family or rebel leaders from escaping the doomed city. The two European officers were Captain Matthew Long and Colonel Sir Roger Goodchild. The name leapt out of the page at me, not only because someone had underlined it in pencil. In the margin, also in pencil, was one of Jimmy North's characteristic exclamation marks. Master James's disrespect for books included those belonging to such a venerable institution as the British Museum. I found I was shaking again, and my cheeks felt hot with excitement. This was the last fragment missing from the puzzle. It was all here now, and my eyes raced on across the page. No one will ever know now what happened on that night on a lonely road through the Indian jungle, but 6 months later Captain Long and the Indian Subedar, Ram Panat, gave evidence at the court-martial of Colonel Goodchild. They described how they had intercepted a party of Indian nobles fleeing the burning city. The party included 3 Muslim priests and 2 princes of the royal blood. In the presence of Captain Long, one of the princes attempted to buy their freedom by offering to lead the British officers to a great treasure, a golden throne shaped like a tiger and with a single diamond eye. The officers agreed, and the princes led them into the forest to a jungle mosque. In the courtyard of the mosque were 6 bullock carts. The drivers had deserted, and when the British officers dismounted and examined the contents of these vehicles, they proved, indeed, to contain a golden throne statue of a tiger. The throne had been broken down into 4 separate parts to facilitate transportation: hindquarters, trunk, forequarters, and head. In the light of the lanterns, these fragments nestled in beds of straw, blazing with gold and encrusted with precious and semi-precious stones. Colonel Roger Goodchild then ordered that the princes and priests should be executed out of hand. They were lined up against the outer wall of the mosque and dispatched with a volley of musketry. The colonel himself walked amongst the fallen noblemen, administering the coup de grace with his service revolver. The corpses were afterwards thrown into a well outside the walls of the mosque. The 2 officers now separated, Captain Long with most of the native troops returning to the patrol of the city walls, while the colonel, Subedar Ram Panat, and 15 sepoys rode off with the bullock carts. The Indian Subedar's evidence at the court-martial described how they had taken the precious cargo westwards, passing through the British lines by the colonel's authority. They camped 3 days at a small native village. Here the local carpenter and his 2 sons laboured under the colonel's direction to manufacture 4 sturdy wooden crates to hold the 4 parts of the throne. The colonel, in the meantime, set about removing from the statue the stones and jewels that were set into the metal. The position of each was carefully noted on a diagram prepared by Goodchild, and the stones were numbered and packed into an iron chest of the type used by army paymasters for the safekeeping of coin and specie in the field. Once the throne and the stones had been packed into the 4 crates and iron chest, they were loaded once more onto the bullock carts, and the journey towards the railhead at Allahabad was continued. The luckless carpenter and his sons were obliged to join the convoy. The Subedar recalled that when the road entered an area of dense forest, the colonel dismounted and led the 3 craftsmen amongst the trees. 6 pistol shots rang out, and the colonel returned alone. I broke off my reading for a few moments to reflect on the character of the gallant colonel. I should have liked to introduce him to Manny Resnick. They would have had so much in common. I grinned at the thought and read on. The convoy reached Allahabad on the 6th day, and the colonel claimed military priority to place his 5 crates upon a troop train returning to Bombay. Having done this, he and his small command rejoined the regiment at Delhi. 6 months later, Captain Long, supported by the Indian petty officer Ram Panat, brought charges against the commanding officer. We can believe that thieves had fallen out. Colonel Goodchild had perhaps decided that 1 share was better than 3. Be that as it may, nothing has since given a clue to the whereabouts of the treasure.
The trial conducted in Bombay was a cause célèbre, and was widely reported in India and at home. However, the weakness of the prosecution's case was that there was no booty to show, and dead men tell no tales. The colonel was found not guilty. However, the pressure of the scandal left him no choice but to resign his commission and return to London. If he managed somehow to take with him the great Mughal diamond and the golden tiger throne, his subsequent career gave no evidence of his possessing great wealth. In partnership with the notorious lady of the town, he opened a gaming house in the Bayswater Road, which soon acquired an unsavoury reputation. Colonel Sir Roger Goodchild died in 1871, probably from tertiary syphilis, contracted during his remarkable career in India. His death revived stories of the fabulous throne, but these soon subsided for lack of hard facts, and the secret passed on with that sporting gentleman. Perhaps we should have headed this chapter, "The Treasure That Never Was." Ah, not on, cock, I thought happily. It was, and is. And I began once more at the beginning of the story. But this time I made careful notes, for Sherry's benefit. She was waiting for me when I returned, sitting wakefully in the armchair by the window, and she flew at me when I entered. "Where have you been?" she demanded. "I've been sitting here all evening, eating my heart out with curiosity." "You're not going to believe it," I told her, and I thought she might do me a violence. "Harry Fletcher, you have got 10 seconds to cut out the introductory speeches and give me the goodies. After that, I scratch your eyes out." We talked until long after midnight, and by then we had the floor strewn with papers over which we pored on hands and elbows. There was an Admiralty chart of the St. Mary's Archipelago, the copies of the drawings of the Dawn Light, the notes I'd made of the mate's description of the wreck, and those I'd made in the reading room of the British Museum. I had out my silver travelling flask, and we drank Shivas Regal from the plastic tooth mug as we argued and schemed, trying to guess in what section of the Dawn Light's hull the 5 crates had been stowed, guessing also how she'd broken up on the reef, what part of her had been washed into the break, and what part had fallen to the seaward side. I had made sketches of 12 eventualities, and I'd opened a running list of my minimum equipment requirements for an expedition, to which I added, as various items came to mind, or as Sherry made intelligent suggestions. I'd forgotten that she must be a first-rate scuba diver, but I was reminded of this as we talked. I was aware now that she would not be a passenger on this exhibition. My feelings towards her were becoming tinged with professional respect, and the mood of exhilaration, mixed with camaraderie, was building to a crescendo of physical tension. Sherry's pale, smooth cheeks were flushed with excitement, and we were shoulder to shoulder as we knelt on the carpeted floor. She turned to say something. She was chuckling, and the blue lights in her eyes were teasing and inviting, and only inches from mine. Suddenly, all the golden thrones and legendary diamonds in the world must wait their turn. We both recognized the moment, and we turned to each other with unashamed eagerness. We were in a consuming fever of urgency, and we became lovers without rising from the floor, right on top of the drawings of the Dawn Light, which was probably the happiest thing that had ever happened to that ill-starred vessel. When at last I lifted her to the bed and we twined our bodies together beneath the quilt, I knew that all the brief, amorous acrobatics that had preceded my meeting with this woman were meaningless. What I had just experienced transcended the flesh and became a thing of the spirit. And if it was not loving, then it was the nearest thing to it that I would ever know. My voice was husky and unsteady with wonder as I tried to explain it to her. She lay quietly against my chest, listening to the words I had never spoken to another woman, and she squeezed me when I stopped talking, which was clearly a command to continue. I think I was still talking, when we both fell asleep.
From the air, St. Mary's has the shape of one of those strange fish from the ocean's abysmal depth, a squat, misshapen body, with stubby body fins and tail fins in unusual places, and a huge mouth, many sizes too big for the rest of it. The mouth was Grand Harbour, and the town nestled in the hinge of the jaws. The iron roofs flash like signal mirrors from the dark green cloak of vegetation. The aircraft circled the island, treating the passengers to a vista of snowy white beaches and water so clear that each detail of the reefs and deeps were whirled and smeared below the surface like some vast surrealistic painting. Sherry pressed her face to the round perspex window and exclaimed with delight as the Fokker Friendship sank down over the pineapple fields, where the women paused in their labours to look up at us. We touched down and taxied to the single tiny airport building, on which a billboard announced St. Mary's Island, Pearl of the Indian Ocean, and below the sign stood two other pearls of great price. I had cabled Chubby, and he'd brought Angelo with him to welcome us. Angelo rushed to the barrier to embrace me and grab my bag, and I introduced him to Sherry. Angelo's whole manner underwent a profound change. On the island there is one mark of beauty that is esteemed above all else. A girl might have buck teeth and a squint, but if she possessed a clear complexion, she would have suitors forming squadrons around her. A clear complexion did not mean that she was free of acne. It was rather a gauge of the colour of the skin, and Sherry must have had one of the clearest complexions ever to land on the island. Angelo stared at her in a semi-catatonic state as she shook his hand. Then he roused himself, handed me back my bag, and instead took hers from her hand. He then fell in a few paces behind her like a faithful hound, staring at her solemnly, and only breaking into his flashing smile whenever she glanced in his direction. He was her slave from the first moment. Chubby trundled forward to greet me with more dignity, as big and timeless as a cliff of dark granite, and his face was contorted in a frown of even greater ferocity than usual, as he took my hand in a huge, horny fist and muttered something to the effect that it was good to see me back. He stared at Sherry, and she quailed a little beneath the ferocity of his gaze. But then something happened that I'd never seen before. Chubby lifted his battered old sea cap from his head, exposing the gleaming, polished brown dome of his pate in an unheard-of display of gallantry, and he smiled so widely that we could see the pink plastic gums of his artificial teeth. He pushed Angelo aside when Sherry's bags were brought out of the hold, picked one up in each hand, and led her to the pickup. Angelo followed her devotedly, and I struggled along in the rear under the weight of my own luggage. It was fairly obvious that my crew approved of my choice for once. We sat in the kitchen of Chubby's house, and Mrs. Chubby fed us on banana cake and coffee, while Chubby and I worked out a business deal. For a hard bargain fee, he would charter his stump boat with its two spanking new Evinrude motors for an indefinite period. He and Angelo would crew it at the old wages, and there would be a large billfish bonus at the end of the charter if it were successful. I went into no detail as to the object of the expedition, but merely let them know that we'd be camping on the outer islands of the group and that Sherry and I would be working underwater. By the time we'd agreed and slapped hands on the bargain, the traditional island rite of agreement, it was mid-afternoon, and the island fever had already started to reassert its hold on my constitution. Island fever prevents the sufferer from doing today what can reasonably be put off until the morrow. So we left Chubby and Angelo to begin their preparations, while Sherry and I stopped only briefly at Mrs. Eddy's for provisions, before pushing the pickup over the ridge and down through the palms to Turtle Bay. "It's storybook," murmured Sherry, as she stood under the thatch on the wide veranda of the shack. "It's make-believe." She shook her head at the sway-bold palm trees and the aching white sands beyond. I went to stand behind her, placing my arms around her middle, and drew her to me. She leaned back against me, crossing her own arms over mine, and squeezing my hands. "Oh, Harry, I didn't think it'd be like this." There was a change taking place within her. I could sense it clearly. She was like a winter plant, too long denied the sun. But there were reserves in her that I couldn't fathom, and they troubled me. She was not a simple person, nor easily understood. There were barriers, conflicts within her that showed only as dark shadows in the depth of her ocean blue eyes. Shadows like those of killer sharks swimming deep. More than once, when she believed herself unobserved, I had caught her looking at me in a manner which seemed at once calculating and hostile, as though she hated me. That had been before we came to the island, and now it seemed that, like the winter plant, she was blooming in the sun, as though here she could cast aside some restraint of the soul which had curbed her spirit before. She kicked off her shoes and, barefooted, turned within my encircling arms to stand upon tiptoe to kiss me. "Thank you, Harry. Thank you for bringing me here." Mrs. Chubby had swept the floors and aired the linen, placed flowers in the jars, and charged the refrigerator. We walked through the shack hand in hand, and though Sherry murmured admiration for the utilitarian decor and solid masculine furnishings, yet I thought I detected that gleam in her eye which a woman gets just before she starts pushing the furniture around and throwing out the lovingly accumulated but humble treasures of a man's lifetime. As she paused to rearrange the bowl of flowers that Mrs. Chubby had placed upon the broad camphor-wood refectory table, I knew we were going to see some changes at Turtle Bay. But strangely, the thought did not perturb me. I realized suddenly that I was sick to death of being my own cook and housekeeper. We changed into swimsuits in the main bedroom, for I'd found in the very few hours since we'd become lovers that Sherry had an overdeveloped sense of personal modesty, and I knew it would take time before I could wean her to the standard casual Turtle Bay swimming attire. However, it was some compensation for my temporary overdress to see Sherry North in a bikini. It was the first time I'd really had an opportunity to look at her openly. The most striking single thing about her was the texture and luster of her skin. She was tall, and if her shoulders were too wide and her hips a little too narrow, her waist was tiny, and her belly was flat, with a small, delicately chiselled navel. I've always thought that the Turks were right in considering the navel as a highly erotic portion of a woman's anatomy. Sherry's would have launched 1,000 ships. She didn't like me staring at her. "Oh, Grandma, what big eyes you've got," she said, and wrapped a towel around her waist like a sarong. But she walked barefooted through the sand with an unconscious push and sway of buttock and breast that I watched with uninhibited pleasure. We left our towels above the high water mark and ran down over the hard, wet sand to the edge of the clear, warm sea. She swam with a deceptively slow and easy stroke that drove her through the water so swiftly that I had to reach out myself and drive hard to catch and hold her. Beyond the reef, we trod water, and she was puffing a little. "Out of training," she panted. While we rested, I looked out to sea, and at that moment a line of double black fins broke the surface together in line abreast, bearing down on us swiftly, and I couldn't restrain my delight. "You're an honored guest," I told her. "This is a special welcome." The dolphins circled us like a pack of excited puppies, gambling and squeaking while they looked Sherry over carefully. I have known them sheer away from most strangers, and it was a rarity for them to allow themselves to be touched on a first meeting, and then only after assiduous wooing. However, with Sherry, it was love at first sight, almost of the caliber that Chubby and Angelo had demonstrated. Within 15 minutes, they were dragging her on the Nantucket sleigh ride while she squealed with glee. The instant she fell off the back of one, there was another prodding her with his snout, competing fiercely for her attention. When at last they had exhausted us both, and we swam in wearily to the beach, one of the big bull dolphin followed Sherry into water so shallow it reached to her waist. There he rolled on his back while she scratched his belly with handfuls of coarse white sand, and he grinned that fixed, idiotic dolphin grin. After dark, while we sat on the veranda and drank whiskey together, we could still hear the old bull whistling and slapping the water with his tail in an attempt to seduce her into the sea again. The next morning, I gamely fought off a fresh onslaught of island fever and the temptation to linger in bed, especially as Sherry awoke beside me with the pink, glossy look of a little girl, and her eyes were clear, her breath sweet, and her lips languorous. We had to check through the equipment we had salvaged from Wave Dancer, and we needed an engine to drive the compressor. Chubby was sent off with a fistful of banknotes and returned with a motor that required much loving attention. As that occupied me for the rest of the day, Sherry was sent off to Mrs. Eddy's for camping equipment and provisions. We had set a 3-day deadline for our departure, and our schedule was tight. It was still dark when we took our places in the boat, Chubby and Angelo at the motors in the stern, and Sherry and I perched like sparrows on top of the load. The dawn was a flaming glory of gold and hot red, promise of another fierce day, as Chubby took us northwards on a course possible only for a small boat and a good skipper. We ran close in on island and reef, sometimes with only 18 inches of water between our keel and the fierce coral fangs. All of us were in a mood of anticipation. I truly do not believe it was the prospect of vast wealth that excited me then. All I really needed in my life was another good boat like Wave Dancer. Rather, it was the thought of rare and exquisite treasure and the chance to win it back from the sea. If what we sought had been merely bullion in bars or coin, I do not think it would have intrigued me half as much. The sea was the adversary, and once more we were pitted against each other. The blazing colours of the dawn faded into the hard, hot blue of the sky as the sun rose out of the sea, and Sherry North stood up in the bows to strip off her denim jacket and jeans. Under them she wore her bikini, and now she folded the clothes away into her canvas duffel bag and produced a tube of sun lotion, with which she began to anoint her fine, pale body. Chubby and Angelo reacted with undisguised horror. They held a hurried and scandalized consultation, after which Angelo was sent forward with a sheet of canvas to rig a sun shelter for Sherry. There followed a heated exchange between Angelo and Sherry. "You will damage your skin, Miss Sherry," Angelo protested, but she drove him in defeat back to the stern. There the two of them sat like mourners at a wake. Chubby's whole face creased into a huge brown scowl, and Angelo openly wringing his hands in anxiety. Finally, they could stand it no longer, and after another whispered discussion, Angelo was elected as emissary once more, and he crawled forward over the cargo to enlist my support. "You can't let her do it, Mr. Harry," Angelo pleaded. "She will go dark." "Well, I think that's the idea, Angelo," I told him. However, I did warn Sherry to take care of the sun at noon. Obediently, she covered herself when we ran ashore on a sandy beach to eat our midday meal. It was the middle of the afternoon when we raised the triple peaks of the Old Men, and Sherry exclaimed, "Just as the old mate described them." We approached the island from the seaside, through the narrow stretch of calm water between the island and the reef. When we passed the entrance to the channel through which I had taken Wave Dancer to escape from the Zimbala crash boat, Chubby and I grinned at each other in fond recollection. Then I turned to Sherry and pointed it out to her. "I plan to set up our base camp on the island, and we'll use the gap to reach the area of the wreck." "It looks a little risky," and she eyed the narrow channel with reserve. "It will save us a round journey of nearly 20 miles each day, and it's not as bad as it looks. Once I took my big 50-foot cruiser through there at full throttle." "You must be crazy." She pushed her dark glasses up on top of her head to look at me. "Well, by now you should be a good judge of that." And I grinned at her and she grinned back. "I'm an expert already," she boasted. The sun had darkened the freckles on her nose and cheeks and given her skin a glow. She had one of those rare skins that don't redden and become angry when exposed to sunlight. Instead, it was the kind that quickly turned into a golden honey brown. It was high tide when we rounded the northern tip of the island into a protected cove, and Chubby ran the whaleboat onto the sand only 20 yards from the first line of palm trees. We offloaded the cargo, carrying it up amongst the palms well above the high water mark, and once again covered it with tarpaulins to protect it from the ubiquitous sea salt. It was late by the time we'd finished. The heat had gone out of the sun, and the long shadows of the palms barred the earth as we trudged inland carrying our personal gear and a 5-gallon container of fresh water. in the back of the most northerly peak, generations of visiting fishermen had scratched out a series of shallow caves in the steep slope. I selected a large cave to act as our equipment store, and a smaller one as living quarters for Sherry and me. Chubby and Angelo chose another for themselves, about 100 yards along the slope, and screened from us by a patch of scrub. I left Sherry to sweep out our new quarters with a brush improvised from a palm frond, and to lay out our sleeping bags on the inflatable mattress, while I took my cast net and went back to the cove. It was dark when I returned, with a string of a dozen big striped mullet. Angelo had the fire burning and the kettle bubbling. We ate in contented silence, and afterwards Sherry and I lay together in our cave and listened to the big fiddler crabs clicking and scratching among the palms. "It's primeval," Sherry whispered, "as though we're the first man and woman in the world." "Me Tarzan, you Jane," I agreed, and she chuckled and drew closer to me. In the dawn, Chubby set off alone in the whaleboat on the long return journey to St. Mary's. He would return next day with a full load of petrol and fresh water in jerry cans, sufficient to last us for 2 weeks or more. While we waited for him to return, Angelo and I took on the wearying task of carrying all the equipment and stores up to the caves. I set up the compressor, charged the empty bottles, and checked the diving gear. And Sherry arranged hanging space for our clothes and generally made our quarters comfortable. The next day, she and I roamed the island, climbing the peaks and exploring the valleys and beaches between. I had hoped to find water, a spring or well overlooked by the other visitors, but naturally there was none. Those canny old fishermen overlooked nothing. The south end of the island, furthest from our camp, was impenetrable with salt marsh between the peak and the sea. We skirted the acres of evil-smelling mud and thick swamp grass. The air was rank and heavy with rotted vegetation and dead fish. Colonies of red and purple crabs had covered the mudflats with their holes, from which they peered stalk-eyed as we passed. In the mangroves the herons were breeding, perched long-legged upon their huge, shaggy nests. And once I heard a splash and saw the swirl of something in one of the swamp pools that could only have been a crocodile. We left the fever swamps and we climbed to the higher ground. Then we picked our way through the thickets of shrub growth towards the southernmost peak. Sherry decided we must climb this one also. I tried to dissuade her, for it was the tallest and steepest. My protests went completely unnoticed, and even after we'd made our way onto a narrow ledge below the southern cliff of the peak, she pressed on determinedly. "If the mate of the Dawn Light found a way to the top, then I'm going up there too," she announced. "You'll get the same view from there as from the other peaks," I pointed out. "That's not the point." "What is the point, then?" I asked. And she gave me the pitying look usually reserved for small children and half-wits, refused to dignify the question with an answer, and continued her cautious sideways shuffle along the ledge. There was a drop of at least 200 feet below us, and if there is one deficiency in my formidable arsenal of talent and courage, it is that I have no head for heights. However, I would rather have balanced on one leg on top of St. Paul's Cathedral than admit this to Miss North, and so, with great reluctance, I followed her. Fortunately, it was only a few paces further that she uttered a cry of triumph and turned off the ledge into a narrow vertical crack that split the cliff face. The fracturing of the rock had formed a stepped and readily climbable chimney to the summit, into which I followed her with relief. Almost immediately, Sherry cried out, "Oh, dear God, Harry, look!" And she pointed to a protected area of the wall in the back of the dark recess. Somebody, long ago, had patiently chipped an inscription into the flat stone surface. "A. Barlow. Wrecked on this place, 14th of October, 1858. As we stared at it, I felt her hand grope for mine and squeeze for comfort. No longer the intrepid mountaineer, her expression was half fearful as she studied the writing. "It's creepy," she whispered. "It looks as though it was written yesterday, not all those years ago." Indeed, the letters had been protected from weathering, so that they seemed fresh cut.
and I glanced around almost as though I expected to see the old seaman watching us. When at last we climbed the steep chimney to the summit, we were still subdued by that message from the remote past. We sat there for almost 2 hours, watching the surf break in long white lines upon Gunfire Reef. The gap in the reef and the great dark pool of the break showed very clearly from our vantage point, while it was just possible to make out the course of the narrow channel through the coral. From here, Arthur Barlow had watched the dawn light in her death throes, watched her broken up by the high surf. "Time is running against us now, Sherry," I told her as the holiday mood of the last few days evaporated. "It's 14 days since Manny Resnick sailed in the Mandrake. He won't be far from Cape Town by now. We'll know when he reaches there."
"How?"
"I have an old friend who lives there. He's a member of the yacht club, and he'll watch the traffic and cable me the moment Mandrake docks." I looked down the back slope of the peak, and for the first time noticed the blue haze of smoke spreading through the tops of the palms from Angelo's cooking fire. "I've been a little half-assed on this trip," I muttered. "We've been behaving like a group of school kids on a picnic. From now on, we'll have to tighten up the security. Just across the channel there is my old friend Suleiman Dada, and Mandrake will be in these waters sooner than I'd like. We'll have to keep a nice low silhouette from now on."
"How long will we need, do you think?" Sherry asked.
"I don't know, my sweeting, but be sure that it'll be longer than we think possible. We are shackled by the need to ferry all our water and petrol from St. Mary's. We will only be able to work in the pool during a few hours of each tide when the condition and the height of the water will let us. Who knows what we're going to find in there once we start? And finally, we may discover that the Colonel's parcels were stowed in the rear hold of the Dawn Light, the part of the ship that was carried out into the open water. If it was, then you can kiss it all goodbye. We've been over that part of it before, you dreadful old pessimist," Sherry rebuked me. "Think happy thoughts." So we thought happy thoughts, and did happy things, until at last I made out the tiny dark speck like a water beetle on the brazen surface of the sea as Chubby returned from St. Mary's in the whaleboat. We climbed down the peak and hurried back through the palm groves to meet him. He was just rounding the point and entering the cove as we came out on the beach. The whaleboat was low in the water under her heavy cargo of fuel and drinking water, and Chubby stood in the stern, as big and solid and eternal as a great rock. When we waved and shouted, he inclined his head gravely in acknowledgement. Mrs. Chubby had sent a banana cake for me and for Sherry, a large sun hat of woven palm fronds. Chubby had obviously reported Sherry's behaviour, and his expression was more than normally lugubrious when he saw that the damage was already being done. Sherry was toasted to an edible medium rare. It was after dark by the time we'd carried 50 jerrycans up to the cave. Then we gathered about the fire where Angelo was cooking an island chowder of clams that he'd gathered from the lagoon that afternoon. It was time to tell my crew the true reason for our expedition. Chubby I could trust to say nothing, even under torture, but I'd waited to get Angelo into the isolation of the island before telling him. He has been known to commit the most monstrous indiscretions, usually in an attempt to impress one of his young ladies. They listened in silence to my explanation, and remained silent after I'd finished. Angelo was waiting for a lead from Chubby, and that gentleman was not one to charge his fences. He sat scowling into the fire, and his face looked like one of those copper masks from an Aztec temple. When he had created the correct atmosphere of theatrical suspense, he reached into his back pocket and produced a purse, so old and well-handled that the leather was almost worn through. "When I was a boy and fished the pool at Gunfire Break, I took a big old daddy grouper fish. When I opened his belly pouch, I found this in him." From the purse he took out a round disc. "I kept it since then like a good luck charm, even though I was offered £10 for it by an officer on one of my ships." He handed me the disc, and I examined it in the firelight. It was a gold coin, the size of a shilling. The reverse side was covered with oriental characters which I couldn't read, but the obverse face bore a crest of 2 rampant lions supporting a shield
and an armoured head. The same design as I had last seen on the bronze ship's bell at Big Gull Island. The legend below the shield read, Aus Regis and Senat Anglia, while the rim was struck with the bold title, English East India Company. I always promised me that I would go back to Gunfire Brick. Looks like this is the time, Chubby went on as I examined the coin minutely. There was no date on it, but I had no doubt that it was a gold mohur of the company. I'd read of the coin, but never seen one before. You got this out of a fish's gut, Chubby? I asked, and he nodded. Guess that old grouper seen it shine and took a snap at it. Must have stuck in his belly until I pulled him out. I handed the coin back to him. Well then, Chubby, that goes to show there is some truth in my story. I guess it does, Harry, he admitted. And I went to the cave to fetch the drawings of the dawn light and a gas lantern. We pored over the drawings. Chubby's grandfather had sailed as a topmastman in the East Indiaman, which made Chubby something of an expert. He was of the opinion that all passengers' luggage and other small pieces would be stowed in the forehold beside the forecastle. I wasn't going to argue with him. Never hex yourself, as Chubby had warned me so often. When I produced my tide tables and began calculating the time differences for our latitude, Chubby actually smiled. Although it was hard to recognize it as such, it looked much more like a sneer, for Chubby had no faith in rows of printed figures in pamphlets. He preferred to judge the tides by the sea clock in his own head. I've known him to call the tides accurately for a week ahead without reference to any other source. I reckon we'll have a high tide at 1:40 tomorrow, I announced. Man, you got it right for once, Chubby agreed. Without the enormous loads that had been forced on her recently, the whaleboat seemed to run with a new lightness and eagerness. The twin Evinrudes put her up on the plain, and she flew at the narrow channel through the reef like a ferret into a rabbit hole. Angelo stood in the bows using hand signals to indicate underwater snags to Chubby in the stern. We had picked good water to come in on, and Chubby met the dying surf with confidence. The little whaleboat tossed up her head and kicked her heels over the swells, splattering us with spray. The passage was more exhilarating than dangerous, and Sherry whooped and laughed with the thrill of it. Chubby shot her through the narrow neck between the coral cliffs with feet to spare on each side, for the whaleboat had half of Wave Dancer's beam. Then we zigzagged through the twisted gut of the channel beyond, and at last burst out into the pool. No good trying to anchor, Chubby growled. It's deep here. The reef goes down sheer. We got 20 fathoms under us here, and the bottom is foul. How are you going to hold it? I asked. Somebody got to sit it a motor and keep her there with power. That's going to chew the fuel up, Chubby. Don't I know it, he growled. With a tide only half made, the occasional wave was coming in over the reef, not yet with much force, just a frothing spill that cascaded into the pool, turning the surface to ginger beer with bubbles. However, as the tide mounted, so the surf would come over stronger. Soon it would be unsafe in the pool, and we'd have to run for it. We had about 2 hours in which to work, depending on the stage of neap and spring tides. It was a cycle of too little or too much. At low tide there was insufficient water to negotiate the entrance channel, and at high tide the surf breaking over the reef might overwhelm the open whaleboat. Each of our moves had to be finely judged. Now every minute was precious. Sherry and I were already dressed in our wetsuits with faceplates on our foreheads, and it was necessary only for Angelo to lift the heavy scuba sets onto our backs and to clinch the webbing harness. "Ready, Sherry?" I asked, and she nodded, the ungainly mouthpiece already stuffed into her mouth. "Right, let's go." We dropped over the side and sank down together beneath the cigar-shaped hull of the whaleboat. The surface was a moving sheet of quicksilver above us, and the spill over the reef charged the upper layer of water with a rash of champagne bubbles. I checked with Sherry. She was comfortable and breathing in the slow rhythm of the experienced diver that conserves air and ventilates the body effectively. She grinned at me, her lips distorted by the mouthpiece and her eyes enormously enlarged by the glass faceplate, and she gave me the high sign with both thumbs. I pointed my head straight for the bottom and began pedalling with my swimming fins, going down fast, reluctant to waste air on a slow descent. The pool was a dark hole below us. The surrounding walls of coral shut out much of the light and gave it an ominous appearance. The water was cold and gloomy. I felt a prickle of almost superstitious awe. There was something sinister about this place, as though some evil and malignant force lurked in the somber depths.